It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, attorneys at law, the right advice at the right time. And join us this morning is Wes Collins. Good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Ben.
What are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about homeowners associations and, you know, restrictions on property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about this topic before. It's a topic that people are often very interested in. We get a lot of calls relating to these issues. But let's just start out by, you know, talking about, you know, what a homeowners association is, what a subdivision is, so on
sure.
and so forth. You know, the folks out there buying property, interested in buying a piece of property, buying a home, that kind of thing. Obviously, one of the things that you need to look into when you're making the determination as to what you want to buy is, you know, what restrictions you may have on that property.
Right, right.
Now, if you're buying in a rural area or you're not in an area where there are covenants or declarations, maybe, you know, some of our old neighborhoods around, then you may not have any restrictions per se other than like ordinances, that type of thing, noise ordinances and, you know, maybe even some parking on the street ordinances and that kind of thing. But if you end up, you know, purchasing property or owning property in an area that's a subdivision, like our Brandywines here in Carteret County.
Sure.
You know, some of the many subdivisions in the various, counties, you know, we can look at the Blair Farm area, so on and so forth. Then, you know, there are going to be, covenants and there is, you know, governed by this homeowners association type, governance and this idea. And basically the way that works, it's a self-governance type thing. I think most people know that, but not to get too much into the details, but the way that essentially works is that, you know, when the property was developed, the developer buys the property.
Right.
Has the plan put in place where the roads are going to be, where the tennis court's going to be, where the maybe boat dock, if there is one, is going to be, swimming pool.
May have a theme.
May have a theme, right? And then identifies where each of the individual lots will be.
Right.
So, you know, in general, the way we break that up is usually the roads, swimming pool, tennis court, maybe a park, that's all referred to as the common area. And then the lots are going to be clearly the individual lots that people will purchase.
Now, at that point, before it's developed, does that, does the developer establish what the covenants are?
Yes, that is very important, for that timing to be correct, because we don't want to sell any lots at all until those covenants or declarations are on record. Because in the event that the property or a lot, a piece of property is sold prior to those declarations or covenants being placed on record, then that particular lot is not subject to those restrictions. So that's the normal course of things, Ben. You know, we identify the property, we develop the property, we put a site plan together, we deal with all the environmental issues, so on and so forth. But before we sell lot number one, you know, we make sure that those declarations and covenants are put on record and are proper in every way as much as possible based on what we think we want this subdivision to be. Now, as time goes on, in many cases, subdivisions may become a little something different than what they initially planned. You know, sometimes the economy won't necessarily support the size house or the size house plan that we're looking at. So maybe we have to downscale and square footage, that type of thing. So in many cases, those covenants may be subject to amendment. And in many cases, the developer even reserves the right to make amendment or reserves the right to have a higher number of votes per lot still owned by the developer.
So they make sure that they have it's kind of like having a majority stake in a corporation.
Until they get to a tipping point. They basically have control.
I think there's some examples around the areas of maybe neighborhoods or developments that were developed for horse owners, for example. And then maybe that didn't pan out quite that way. So it may change.
That's exactly right. So, you know, the things that we look at with these subdivisions, homeowners associations, as far as the governing documents go, and if you've listened to us speak about this before or get calls on the air about this before, mm-hmm. you'll know that just about every situation and every question, our initial response is, well, the governing documents would control. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where we start in almost every situation with subdivisions, you know, about enforceability and these type
right.
things.
And the devil's in the details.
Devil's
right.
in the details. So what we look at as it relates to the enforceability is, number one, when your association is set up, it's set up as a nonprofit corporation mm-hmm. under North Carolina General Statute 55A, and documents called articles of incorporation are filed with the North Carolina Secretary of State. That brings life to the corporation.
Now, might the developers start this process?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And then, you know, we have bylaws mm-hmm. that would be adopted. Those bylaws basically serve to give us direction as it relates to our meetings, mm-hmm. notices for meetings, our officers, our directors, who is going to control, what's the voting process for bringing in new members. That's where we go to with regard to that type of governance mm-hmm. of the corporation.
Right. And that's where we start to see people get confused about what are maybe between bylaws and covenants, right?
That's right. We also get people.
This is because this is a subject, this is the point where people are often asking questions. You can do that, 800-818-2255, or you can call Mandy at these local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
Right. So when we're talking about these governing documents, the bylaws are really going to provide governance and direction for the corporation itself. Mm-hmm. But then when we're talking about things like what we can and cannot do on our property or on the common area, mm-hmm. we then look at the declarations, the covenants. Those mm-hmm. are documents that would be in the chain of title. They would be recorded in the courthouse wherever the property is located in that county. And they're going to, include those restrictions. Mm-hmm. And the restrictions could be, you know, anything from the square footage size of your home, that right. type of limitation. There could be impervious surface issues with mm-hmm. regard to that. Sometimes we have stormwater management language in covenants that only allows a certain amount of impervious area. Mm-hmm. You know, we could have things about, you know, no basketball goals.
Right.
We can have things about discretion of the architectural control committee with regard to improvement on the property.
And that's in a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
The architectural control committee, though, would be, its operation would be in the bylaws. Is that right?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, they would probably be a committee appointed by the board of directors mm-hmm. through the bylaws.
Mm-hmm.
But their power comes from the covenants.
From the covenants, okay.
Because when we're talking about restricting folks' use of their mm-hmm. property, then, you know, we have to be very specific about what that restriction may be.
Okay.
Because, you know, when you go buy a piece of property and the covenant says, you know, something that's somewhat nebulous or objective about what you can or cannot do on your property, mm-hmm. you know, the court, if we're looking at enforceability of that, is not going to really fall on the side of the restriction. They're going to fall on the side of free use of property.
Right.
Because
right.
as we've talked about before, Ben, on the program, you know, one of the most powerful tenets in the law with regard to real property is highest and best use.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to tie people's hands with regard to the use of the property that they use, that they spent their own good money on.
Right.
We want highest and best and free use. So the devil is in the details with regard to these covenants mm-hmm. and with regard to these declarations.
And then we back to that architectural review committee.
That's right. We need to see specific language as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But in some cases, we have more general discretionary type language about what will and will not be allowed at the opinion of an architectural control committee.
Okay. We'll bring up the matter of sheds. That seems to be the one that always trips
yeah.
people up.
We got a lot of shed and fence cases over the years.
That's right. We'll look at those coming up in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak and Let's Talk Legal. Wes Collins joining us from Harvell & Collins. Hey, welcome back here at Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station FM 107 and AM 1240. Thanks for joining us here today. And, of course, Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning. Your calls are welcome at 800-818-2255 or the local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
And Wes Collins with us from Harvell and Collins here on Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about Homeowners Association. I've mentioned sheds because sheds and fences seem to be a very typical. Why are they such a typical kind of case that comes up?
Well, in many cases, you know, folks want a shed of a certain size and color and roof pitch and blah, 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 and the covenants don't allow it.
Right.
Or the fences have restrictions with regard to that. Or probably more often than not, we have an architectural control committee that won't allow one of the two, but perhaps there's not a specific restriction indicating you can't have you know, one of the two. So let's talk about that for just a second, because we do see in usually older covenants, which I have to say that most of the covenants that we look at, you know, are older.
Yeah,
it's not like
we
have new subdivisions popping up every day. You know, we're maybe somewhat saturated with regard to that. So, you know, if you have some of these older covenants that state that the Architectural Control Committee has, you know, overriding power as it relates to what you can build and what you can't build, including fences and
sheds
and whatever, doghouses, you know, stuff like that, then it's not in fact true that the Architectural Control Committee has complete carte blanche power to do what they want to do. What they have to do is that they certainly would have the right to evaluate your plans before you go build what you're planning on building. But they can only restrict your construction and what you plan to build in the event that it's reasonably determined that what you're proposing is not consistent with the common scheme or plan. Okay, so if we have, you know, 4 foot high black metal fences of a certain type in, you know, multiple yards throughout the subdivision.
Right.
And all of a sudden this Architectural Control Committee says, well, we're not going to allow that here.
Right.
Well, it's obviously the common scheme or plan to allow that here.
It had been. There's precedent.
So then my question as the attorney would then be, all right, show me in the covenants where it indicates we can't have that. And if it doesn't state that, then we fall back to the common scheme or plan. And if it is commonly seen throughout the subdivision, then the Architectural Control Committee would not have the authority to restrict it. Now, as we were talking about off the air, you know, if someone wanted to build a 15-foot high privacy fence all around their house, you know, or a moat or something, that would be a little different. But, but you know, as long as the Architectural Control Committee is restricting the use of property consistent with the common scheme or plan, and there is, as you can tell, some of a, you know, subjective type standard with regard to that.
We've talked before about sometimes because different people get voted on to different boards, and they may be in that committee or in the board of directors.
Right.
How can that change the flavor of those decisions?
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, you know, when we deal with homeowners associations, one of the reasons that folks end up in my office, the attorney's office, is because of personalities.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, certain board members might see things one way and other board members might see something a different way. I mean, we just have to try to create that continuity from one group to the next. That's one of the reasons we have staggered terms, so we don't have just a completely new board that's trying to figure out what the old board did.
Right.
You know, and also that's, I think, what our courts are trying to perpetuate as well through this common scheme or plan. Although the previous board may, or Architectural Control Committee may have had a certain opinion about the way things should have been done in the subdivision, it's pretty easy for anybody to drive around and kind of look at what is the common scheme or plan. So
there's the common the sense understanding.
That's right. Common sense understanding. So, you know, another area, Ben, that we get into and what we've talked about thus far is kind of the way a subdivision set up, a homeowners association. We talked about the bylaws and the covenants and the declaration and architectural control committee and those type restrictions. You know, we then get into oftentimes the issue about, you know, what if there is a violation? You know, what if there's a violation of the covenants as it relates to, you know, parking
your boat
on your trailer in your driveway for too long? Or what if it's, you know, you're not allowed to have that outbuilding and you build it anyway? You know, what happens then? Well, every case is different because we have to look at the governing documents. We have to look at the actual facts, what transpired, what kind of notice was given, those type things. But in general, the association would normally have the right to assess a fine. They don't have the right to come on your property and take your basketball goal down. They don't have the right to come and take your mailbox. That's a trespass. They don't have the right to do those type things, but they would have the right to give you notice of the particular violation and then allow you to have a hearing. That's going through the due process. Exactly. Guaranteed rights, constitutional rights, a due process, so you can put on your evidence as to why you think you're not in violation. And then the association would have the right to fine you not more than $100 per day. And they can't start that fine until that due process is finished. And then 5 days have to be added to the end of that. And that's when the $100 or whatever they decide, but not more than $100 per day, could be assessed against you. And the idea here is that is the motivation for you to change your ways.
Now, it's one thing to remove a basketball goal.
Right.
It's another thing to take a roof off.
Yep, that's correct. And a lot of times when we get to that kind of money, you know, that kind of issue, you know, we end up in court.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, happens sometimes. You know, and sometimes we have situations where maybe there was some verbal approval. Oh yeah, you can, that roof's fine. Looks good, great.
Yeah, right.
Sounds good, go ahead. It gets built based on that affirmation. And then maybe a neighbor complains about it.
Right.
And then it formally comes before the Architectural Control Committee and a decision is then made. And here we are in a $25,000, $30,000 fix in front of us.
I think I imagine there's language sometimes when you are defending somebody about that, about somebody knew or should have known.
Stop. You're stopped from now enforcing this because one of your members approved it and I relied upon that representation. So we deal with these kind of situations, you know, quite often for folks because there's confusion with subdivisions and homeowners associations.
Right. I want to ask you about, when we come back to the break, if it's different and you're looking at a condo association or townhouses or something like that. We'll get to that coming up in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak. Your calls are welcome. 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. As we talk about homeowners associations with Wes Collins of Harvell & Collins. And welcome back to Let's Talk Legal. I said that when I look at condos or townhomes, I think one of the things that happens there is that you have often with those, well, you do with many neighborhoods too, but you have amenities, a pool, tennis court. So are covenants governing the use of those or are those rules that are established by association? How does that work?
Right. In many cases, we have provisions in our covenants or declarations that do in fact reference the particular common areas. Even that there may be a committee that has authority over the common areas or the board has authority over the common areas. So sometimes we have specific objective standards with regard to the use of the common area. But in many cases, it's left open-ended so that the association has the right to impose reasonable rules and regulations for the use of the common areas. Sometimes the associations get confused about that and try to impose rules upon individual lots. That there's some confusion there. I mean, it's not as though the association through its board has control over all of the property within the subdivision to the point where they can just decide what the rule is for the use of parking in your driveway. No, that really would fall into those specific objective standards with regard to, you know, what the covenant state. Can you or can you not park your boat in the driveway? Can you or can you not have a camper trailer in the driveway? You know, those kind of things. So, but when we're talking about the common area, the pool, tennis court, so on and so forth, many times we do see reasonable rules and regulations such as we're going to impose some rules with regard to pool hours.
Right.
right. with regard to birthday parties there,
right.
with regard to how many people can swim in the pool.
All right, we'll right. see if we can get David's question in here in the last few minutes that we have. David in Jacksonville. Hi, David.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
Fine.
Quick question.
Yeah.
My neighborhood has an HOA, and the past two presidents have not been fulfilling their duties as far as having the annual meetings, enforcing the rules and regulations. And what would be the – could we go ahead and just disassemble the HOA, or is there a certain process you have to go through?
What happens when there's no governance?
Yeah, you know, David, great question. We just have a couple minutes here. You know, we see that fairly frequently where, you know, you have covenants or declarations. There was an intent to have an association, but there's really no action. There's no board. There's no officers. Nobody's doing anything. And, you know, there could be a dissolution of the corporation, but you really would need to have we'd have to look at the governing documents again, but in most cases, you probably are going to have at least two-thirds of the property owners agree with that
mm-hmm.
by an actual vote, or 100%. We would have to look at that. What happens in many cases, though, is if you just don't have anyone, you know, captain of the ship, then there's just no one captain of the ship.
Yep.
And the covenants stay on record. But basically, just by the fact that the association is not operating, it's just, you know, by default becomes, you know,
can a property owner bring an action under a covenant though?
Yes, that's a great question. I mean, even if you don't have an actual board in place, you don't have officers in place, even if you have those covenants in place, which it sounds like you probably do, and there's a violation, an individual property owner in almost every case would have the right to enforce those, would have the right to say, you know, next door neighbor, these covenants don't allow you to put the basketball goal up, so I'm going to enforce that. Now, there's a process that you would have to go through in order to do that, but usually covenants under North Carolina law are enforceable individually.
Can a homeowner call a meeting of the association if there hasn't been one?
Yes. Normally you can call a special meeting. You have to request normally first of the association for them to do that. And in the event they don't, you can notice up the meeting yourself. We have to look at the bylaws with regard to that.
It's back to the governing documents.
Back to the governing documents. David, thank you.
Thank you. Great question, though, and a great possibility for some people to get organized if they aren't.
That's right.
All right. If you want to find out more about that, you can call on Wes and call him at 726-9050 and make your appointment with HarvellandCollins.com.